Hello, everybody. This is the IT Babble Podcast, your source of everything educational technology. Happy Thanksgiving to all you people out there, all you Americans out there, that is. And I am Patrick Hawley, recording here in Indianapolis, Indiana, on a beautiful November day. And I am joined by my good friend over in Seoul, well, not Seoul, but in South Korea for sure, Mr. Tony DePrato. Tony, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. I'm in Jeju, South Korea. It's a little island off the coast of the mainland, but it's okay. No one knows where it's at, so it's how we like it.
I like to call it the Hawaii of the Far East because it is.
That's right.
It is an island.
A lot of people do call it the Hawaii of the Far East because we have lava tubes and all that other stuff.
Well, that's pretty cool. I didn't know that. Didn't know that. And for the people out there listening, you're going to hear a buzzing noise. That buzzing noise is because I have an audio cable that needs to be replaced, and it is letting electrical interference pass through it. I think that's what it is. Tony, would you agree? Does that sound?
Yeah, I think that's what it is, and we don't have time to replace it right now.
No.
So we're really sorry, but we're aware of it. There's no need to let us know.
Yeah, and it's not your headphones. It's us. In fact, in more particular, it's me. So, yep, just bear with us, and you probably will forget it's even there, hopefully. Hopefully. But on another note, we have a fantastic agenda. I mean, it was good. Tony, did you hear the last show with Omar? Oh, it was a good show.
I did listen to it.
But I think this show is going to be even better. We're going to be talking about educational technology. Does it need to be its own discipline? That means, do you need to go and be like, well, I can major in elementary education, I can, you know, middle school math, or I can do educational technology. Do universities really need that? We'll talk about pros and cons on that one. We're going to talk about Apple's Swift language, and now Apple's pushing universities outside of, I guess, North America to kind of offer this as like a, you know, as its own discipline. Where people can do it. And, you know, we got some questions about that. But we're going to start with this article I saw in The Atlantic by, I don't know how to say this name, but I'm going to give it a try, Lulade Fadula. And the title is The Push for Education Programs That Pay People As They Learn. And the article is all about apprenticeships. And I think this is, with the skyrocketing cost of, I don't know about outside of America, but in America, university, the cost is extraordinary now. It's very expensive, even for a state school. And I'm thinking this is maybe a really good alternative for people. And I don't know, Tony, what do you think there? What do you think?
Well, I think that it's a fairly new trend that people started doing internships without getting money. So I did some internships when I was in university, and I wasn't paid for them. But when I would talk to older people, they were like, no, when I was in high school, I did apprenticeships, and we were paid. And it actually makes sense. I mean, if you do like an internship or an apprenticeship and you're not being paid, isn't it technically slave labor? I mean, like, what do you work? You're like, oh, I'm working for the reference. It's like, that's not really going to help you unless the person you're working for can guarantee you that there's going to be a job on the other end somewhere.
Now, see, my wife, she did an internship for at FedEx and their marketing and internal communications, and she was actually paid for that, but it was a very small amount of money. It wasn't it was almost like a stipend rather than like an hourly wage or anything. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I think people shouldn't work for free. There's times in my life where I did stuff for free. Just, I need to show them I can do this or I can do that.
Yep.
I used to work with this guy, and he said, if you want to take that approach, you go into a company and you tell them that you'll do something for them for free for no more than 2 weeks. And at the end of the 2 weeks, you say, is this going to work out or not? And then you leave. And I always thought that was somewhere like in the middle with the advice. And, you know, it says I'm looking for some definitions and comparisons for internship versus apprenticeship. And I think in general, in modern terms, an apprenticeship is paid, whereas an internship may or may not be paid.
Yeah, and when I think of an apprentice, I think of somebody performing a specialized task. You know, it's
right.
You know, it's not like, oh, I'm learning how to drive a bus, drive a public bus or something like that. It's like, oh, I'm learning how to be an electrician, or I'm learning how to be a blacksmith, or maybe perhaps even a nursing, or even teachers. I could even see that for sure. So we're not talking about, you know, somebody out there like with a pickaxe, you know, digging a hole in the earth for a ditch or anything like that, where you probably don't need a whole lot of apprenticeship, just some strong muscles and a strong back, you know.
What I think another issue now is, let's say that you take a free internship at a company for a month and you're not getting any credit for it. So if you're getting university credit back, meaning I do the internship in lieu of going to class, I think that's totally fine. Because you paid the university, the university's worked the internship out. As long as it goes well, you get job experience and you've earned credit to graduate. I think that's okay. But let's say that you're working somewhere for a month and they have you doing some kind of IT-related job, which a lot of them would be, and you like set up a new database for the company, or you make some advanced like Excel setup for them. What kind of value are they getting out of that long term? I mean, it's huge.
Yeah.
You're not getting anything and you don't own it. Like, there's no intellectual property there. You've done all that work. You probably can't take it with you, and you're not getting paid for it. So I think that the model definitely needs to change. And I think you're right. I mean, when students graduate from high school now, they really need to think, should I go straight into a university program? Or should I work and do something and make a little bit of money and figure out what I want to do? Because the cost of education is too high.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure there are some people out there who can, you know, well, I'm going to spend 6 to 10 years in university and, you know, my parents are wealthy and I've got money and it's okay. I can do this. But for most people, you kind of really have to know what you want to do. And at the ripe age of 18, not everybody knows what they want to do with their life. So apprenticeship, I think, also, is a great way of.
Yeah, and there's another thing that I've noticed lately. So when I was in high school, I understood that when I was in grade 10, all the courses offered to me in grade 10, I needed to pass them because all of them counted for my GPA. All of them counted towards my graduation. If I took an elective like Spanish and I failed it, then that lowered my GPA, and I couldn't take Spanish over and over. I might be able to take it one more time if I took it in grade 9 or 10, but if I failed it in grade 11, I wasn't able to take it in grade 12. There was no time.
Yeah.
And so there was this sense of, you know, you have to complete the program. You don't really have a choice, and you have to take each class seriously. And university is still like that. So I've ran into people who can't do university anymore, and they never graduated because they switched programs so many times and they failed enough credits that the university was like, you have so many fails that your GPA will never be high enough to get a diploma.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew a guy who was in computer science, and he was, he went from engineering to computer science to like general biology, but he failed. He just kept failing, and it was like it finally got to the point where they're like, you can't going to be able to pass. And
the reason I'm bringing this up, I'm noticing more and more kids in middle school and high school are coming through from elementary programs where there's no grading, and it's like I think standards based grading and like real time feedback is awesome, but if a student cannot have a sense of failure when they're young. When they're in these high school programs, they think that, oh, I'll just do it again, or it doesn't matter. And they care about their grades, but they don't know how to manage. They don't know how to manage the load. So it's like, okay, the only thing that matters is math and English. It's like, no, you can't fail history.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that. And I think that's a huge problem. And so I think actually developing companies need to start developing apprenticeship programs because they're going to have a huge workforce coming up that can't go to school.
Yeah.
You know, for one reason or the other, they either literally barely passed high school or had to just take a GED or something, because by the time they got to high school, they started to learn what failure was, and they didn't have enough time to kind of learn how to correct their own like behavior and practice. Or they get out of high school and university is so expensive, and at this point, everyone's afraid of student loans. So without companies offering apprenticeships to train people to do work, I don't know how they're going to get – I don't know how they're going to find people.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's – and they even mentioned that in The Atlantic. I mean, they're talking about more – not professional jobs, but lower, slightly under that. But it's a really good point. I think taking a couple years off between high school and college is a great idea if you can do it, and just kind of go out there and see what you want. I had a friend of mine who went right to university, and he dropped out after a sophomore year. He had fine grades, money wasn't an issue. He's like, I don't know what I want to do. And so he spent 4 years working as a car salesman, but exploring all sorts of other, you know, avenues and opportunities. And so when he went back, he's like, I know what I want to do. I want to go into business. I want to be kind of an entrepreneur. And that's what he does now. And he's got his own brewery and he loves it and it's successful and he's doing well. But if he hadn't to take that time off, and if he hadn't gotten some experience outside of school, I don't know if he ever would have come to that conclusion. I don't know if that's where he would have landed or ended up, or so. Kind of interesting. You know, you people out there, don't think college is the end-all be-all. It doesn't, you know, it's certainly a good goal to try to achieve, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to, you know, put all your hopes and dreams onto those higher institutions.
That's true. Especially right out of high school.
Yeah, yeah. And at that cost, too. I mean, there's no guarantee that it's, even if you complete your degree, that you're going to be... that you're going to be hired or be successful in that field, you know. So anyway, some food for thought for people out there. I think that's good. That's really good. And speaking of higher education, and there is kind of a movement right now to make educational technology its own discipline. So you'd go there, and instead of just I think these are master's degrees that they talk about in these articles. They are talking about like a very specific educational technology degree. It may not be called that, but that's pretty much what it is. And the Inside Higher Education, higher ed.com, Carl Stromsheim.
Man, you're picking some tough articles this week.
Man, what I do this to myself. Anyway, he wrote an article called Contours of a New Discipline, where he's talking about Georgetown University. And they have this Center for New Designs in Learning and Scholarships, and they call it CANDLES for short. But there they, you know, you can get pretty much an educational technology master's degree. And so there is a couple of other articles. I didn't link to them in the show notes. This was the best one that I could find, that kind of described the degree and what it offered and everything. And there seems to be a lot of other universities seemed to be kind of jumping onto this idea. And what do you think about that, Tony? Do you think that's...
Well, I specifically did my master's degree in educational technology because I figured out what I wanted to do, and I realized that although there were just maybe two or three places I could do my degree, that it was the only thing that was going to like actually help me. Like, I could have just gotten some type of degree that people would have accepted, but when I looked over the program criteria, I realized, hey, I'm like an IT person coming into the education world. I need someone to help me like understand it and figure out where I fit in it. And if you're coming from the other side, you're a teacher and you actually want to get into working with technology like professionally, it's not trivial. It takes a lot of time, and you need people to mentor you, because there are a lot of rules and processes that you have to follow for things. And what I find is people are like, well, I'm just going to be the ed tech, you know, coordinator, and someone else will take care of all the support. It doesn't work like that. If you have technology connected to any part of your job title, you're going to have to do support for people. You're going to have to help people. You're going to have to give advice. You might even have to help, like, your support people do support, meaning coming up with a process to help them. Because what happens is new products come online every day, new things come out, and everyone has to learn them. Everyone has to learn how to support them. And if you don't understand how these things work, if you don't understand things like licenses and how software works, how, you know, what's the difference between a cloud-hosted license and one that you host on campus? If you don't understand that stuff, you can't get your programs going. And I'm kind of running into that a little bit right now. So my new school has different layers, and some of those layers were brought online before I was hired. And the people in charge of those areas, they ordered a bunch of stuff last year. And as that stuff has arrived, I'm looking at it, and some of it is, it's useless. We can't use it. Like, it's not compliant in one way or the other. And we have some subscriptions that came in, and I didn't make the subscription order. Somebody else did back before I was hired, and the licensing is all wrong. And, you know, their logic for the license can't be flawed, but they didn't read the license. They didn't read over the licensing. Mm-hmm. They literally sent an order to a company, and the company filled it. So, you know, there's a lot of that, and thinking that you don't have to worry about it is naive. And then thinking you can just learn it all by yourself without any mentorship, at least mentorship. So let's say you're not doing a university program. You need to find someone who's doing the job, and you need to be able to work with them on and off for a couple of years, even if it's just remotely. There's just so many decisions to make. Like, I've been using PowerSchool now for a little over 5 years. I still have a PowerSchool mentor, someone I talk to pretty much once or twice, like once a week or once every other week for about 30 minutes, because there's a lot of core decisions and people are like, oh, well, I just want to be a teacher. I'm not going to use PowerSchool. It's like, yes, you are.
You can't use it.
You can't just use PowerSchool as a teacher if you're running any kind of program that involves iPads or laptops or large groups of students, because you need student data every day. One of the most common things to do is to print little labels and tags for things with student names on them, to run off like lists of like common passwords.
Yeah.
All that stuff starts in PowerSchool or your school's information system, even if it's just Excel. You have to manage all that data in order to get people into the environment to work. I suppose if you're running a completely like ad hoc system where your internet is provided through your like 4G company and you have nothing inside your building and all the kids just come in with their own like equipment and packages, maybe that's possible, but I don't think that's normal.
Yeah, well said. Well said. And you see, I have a different view of the educational technology. I've run into people who are teachers who have gotten the educational technology, like masters, but they don't, you know, they just want to be considered technologically savvy. It's almost something they just want to put on their resume, and then when you actually get down to it, they don't have a lot of experience with technology, and they don't know much about technology, and so their focus is like, well, how can I use this in my classroom? And that's to the extent. Like outside of that, they don't know anything about it. Yeah. And also another thing, and maybe you've gone through this, so maybe I'm wrong here, but I find that a lot of these degrees are immediately timely. So they're about technology, about happening right there and right then.
That is correct.
And the second that they get the diploma in their hand, that diploma starts to age probably a lot quicker than, say, maybe in just your basic education diploma. And I'm not saying it's not valuable or it's not, you know, but I talked with a teacher and she's like, oh yeah, I've got my educational technology degree. And I was like, wow, that's awesome. But she got it back in 1997 and hasn't really done much with it since then. And I mean, her extent was, you know, they were coding with Basic and
you know, there weren't a lot of Web 2.0 options back then. And yeah, so it's just that degree now is not very useful, right? What what she learned for that degree is not very applicable now.
Any ed tech master's or preparatory course or certificate that is focused on a product or really stresses products, like this is how you solve that problem with this, it's going to be a waste of time.
Yeah.
Like, one thing I remember in my program, and I did my program in 2001, like that's a long time ago, but there are some core things, maybe values, that they just drilled into us. And one of them was, if you're not constantly creating opportunity, you're not doing your job.
Oh, that's a good one.
What? And so every day I look around and I say, are these kids and teachers getting any new opportunities, or are they just moving around in a circle? Because the second they're moving around in a circle, you need to do something different.
Yeah.
And that's what you're looking at. And once they kind of drill that into your head, and they don't just say it, they give you examples over and over and over. And they make you read things that have nothing to do with education, because a lot of the good theory comes out of the business world.
Yeah,
where critical technology has to evolve or companies go out of business. Yep. And work culture comes out of the business world. Like, how do we get what we need to get done, maintain a standard, and also kind of protect our investment in our like intellectual property? And intellectual property, what does it mean and how do you manage it? And all of that stuff comes from the business world, and it's boring. It's really boring. And you read case studies that have nothing to do with your job at the moment. But that's the thing. It's like, that's just at the moment. You don't know what's coming down the pipe. And I think the other thing is just you learn how to talk to people from different disciplines, because, you know, you've got something on the agenda today about Apple Swift coding.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get an unbiased opinion on Swift coding. So I absolutely did not look on any educational technology websites. I went to websites where programmers complain about coding and their bosses, and I read through it, and it's all jargon, and it's all, we used it for this or we used it for that, and this is how we were able to like solve this problem, this is how much time we saved. You have to understand how to reach out to those different communities, because the technology that's going down to your students should be and usually is just a derivative. It's a simplified version of what's out there in the real world. And so if you're just like, hey, I'm doing an ed tech program and it's all based on Skype, that's great. And Skype's going to like change in 6 months, and you're going to have to cancel your account and make a new one because they refuse to verify your identity anymore. That happened to me. And there's nothing.
This sounds very personal.
There's nothing you can do about it. What can you do? You can't do anything. You got to move on.
I lost my Hotmail account that way. And they're like, how do we know this is you? And I was like, and they asked me, you know, I couldn't call anybody. There was no phone number. There was nothing to do. You know, this was on a chat and Microsoft support. This is in a chat. And they're like, I'm sorry, I'm ending this conversation and you do not have your account. And that was the end of it. That was it. It was over. My account was gone.
So I do think in summary, ed tech is a complete discipline. I don't know if you need a standalone degree for it or you just need a formal way to study it. But it's a discipline just like art or music or anything else. It's got its own set of skills, and it connects to different industries, and it directly connects to industry. It's not theoretical.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Like Patrick, you don't have a degree in ed tech, but I think you're research minded and you're always asking a lot of questions and you think things are awesome, but you also ask a lot of questions like, this is really cool, but how much is it going to cost?
Yeah.
How do we use it? How much money does your company have? Are you a startup? Are you just going to go out of business in a year? Like once I was asking about Edmodo because it's free, and you're like, look, here's, and you knew it. You were like, here's Edmodo's funding for the next 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you showed it to me and you're like, they're good for 10 years. People need to do that. If you're not doing that, then, you're making a lot of bad bad choices because things are like have some bling.
Yeah, yeah, because it looks great right now, but it could be gone tomorrow. And we've experienced that where we have used a service, or maybe not heavily relied, but use a service, and then all of a sudden it's gone. It's just gone. Like MailChimp had a great add-on for Google Docs where you can mail merge, and it was awesome. It was great. But MailChimp, they're like, we're giving this away for free, and no, we're not doing this anymore. And they just shut it down because they wanted to drive people to their MailChimp.com service and to sign up and to use it there, not through Google, which is, you know, it's a good decision, but, you know, it hurt. I had to go and I had to scramble, find something else. But it's all right. I did. I found something. But a problem I have with the EdTech degree, Tony, is that it's not specified enough. So some schools offer it with, this is an educational technology degree, and you are going to go into educational technology administration. You're going to be a director of technology, or you're going to be head of support, or maybe you're going to be doing purchasing, or you're going to have some sort of, you're going to use this as an administrative role. And then you have other universities that offer it, and it's very teacher oriented. It's like, hey, check out Edmodo, check out PicMonkey, check out all these cool services that you can use with your kids right now that'll make your teaching better. And I think there's just what educational technology means as a discipline. I don't know. I think it should be more of the administrative side than it should be of saying, well, I'm going to be ed tech, and just, you know, teach computer technology at my school, or I don't know. I just want a little bit more to it. And Audrey Waters of Hack Education, she does not like the idea of, and she wrote an article on her blog, Hack Education, Disciplining Education Technology, where she said there's so many blogs out there, there's so many communities out there, there's so many conferences that are just focused on educational technology that you can get all the education you really need. You don't have to go and get a degree, and the degree is kind of redundant. It's not really necessary.
Right.
And I thought that was an interesting point that, you know, there's so many, because this is, I mean, just working with you and other people and networking and connecting and going to some conferences, and I get tons of good ideas and hear other people's problems and how they deal with them. And that's far more useful than, I'd say, sitting in a classroom and reading about Google Apps for Education.
I would agree. So if you're doing any kind of program at all, if you're doing a master's level program, if it doesn't contain a lot of case studies for whatever you're studying, if there aren't case studies, just like, you know, like an encyclopedia of this is all the stuff that happened to these people,
yeah,
and what caused it, or videos where people talk about this is how this works, this is what happens if you don't do it right, you're not going to get that much out of it. That's what you need. You need to try to get the human experience to make sense of it. You can learn the skills online or buy a book or watch a training video. Like, the skill stuff is easy, but the real difficult part is knowing the long-term consequences, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like when I was in Dubai and I took over for you, you showed me the GLPI inventory system. And in my new job here, there was no inventory system at all. And so I set one up, and I spent like a good month just working on that and getting everything cataloged and input. And already it has been very helpful. We've been able to, we were working on the budget, so we knew exactly how old, like what computers needed to be replaced. It was all in the inventory. It was all right there. And we're using it to roll out a new student printing system, and we're using their inventory number as kind of a way to authenticate, to set up their accounts.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah. I mean, it's there. It's not going to change for our one-to-one program. So they'll have the same inventory number from, you know, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, unless they get a new device. But, yeah, so they keep that same inventory system, so that means their printing will continue from year to year. And, it's good, right? It's already helping out and establishing new processes for us, and it's good stuff. Yeah, but without talking with you and without you showing me this, like, this isn't something I think I would have learned in a college class, you know?
No.
We may have talked about inventory, but
I only learned it because I walked into like what I would consider an emergency situation with equipment, and I needed a fast and free way to catalog thousands of pieces of equipment. So I started researching it. And then, you know, I suffered through the initial year, and then I probably redid it, the templates, a few times. But now I could sit down with somebody in about a half an hour, explain to them what they need to do.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And just going through there, when I talked to my IT team, I was like, have you guys thought about doing an inventory? And they're like, yeah, but they clearly hadn't thought about it deeply enough to actually know of any solutions out there. And I'm like, look, this is a free one. It's not going to cost us anything. We looked at some paid inventory systems, and they were anywhere from $600 to $1,500 a year.
And I was they're expensive.
And I was like, this is free. We can manage it ourselves. It's a little bit more work on our end, but it's completely free. We have complete control over it, and it's working out pretty well. GLPI, people. GLPI. I wrote a couple of articles about it. It's good stuff. GLPI.org. It is French. Yep. It is French, though.
That's the only downside, but it works.
But it works. But the latest version, I think 9.0.3 or something like that, lets you choose English right from the start. You don't have to go and change, install it, and then change the language like you had to. It gives you a choice of English and a bunch of other languages right from the start. So,
yeah. It's way better now, actually.
It is. It is. It's fantastic. And it integrates with other systems. Anyway, we're not talking about GLPI. We can do that later. Inventories are important. You need to get one if you don't have one, people. So this brings us to our final topic here. I saw this by John Russell in TechCrunch. Apple's Everyone Can Code initiative expands to colleges and universities outside the U.S. So they are... And this is using their Swift coding language, which is I believe it's just for the iOS devices, so iPads,
iPod
Touches, iPhones. Yep.
You can. So I'm just going to amend that because I decided to get into this quickly. iOS, iOS devices, Apple. You can write apps for the laptops, and you can directly write apps for the Apple Watch and for the Apple TV.
Oh, yeah, forgot. Those are iOS devices as well. I forgot about those, yes.
Yeah, but Apple expanded the license, and now you can also write Linux server apps with Swift.
Holy smokes.
That's what I was getting into today. And you can also, we'll talk about it a little bit more, but since they've open sourced it, there's been a bigger adoption than I think most people have realized, way more than I realized. And even though we just spoke about like jumping on the bandwagon, Swift isn't really new. And I just did a little bit of a trial this morning. And so now I've got to try to work it into the curriculum. I really do.
Wow.
It's too big. It's too big. It's going to grow quickly. And I think it's going to be one of the top, what they call full stack languages that will work on. It'll work on not just devices, but at the network level. And I think it's going to go there pretty quick because IBM is pushing it hard.
Wow. And they are all about enterprise solutions. That's what that's their, I think, entire focus now. I don't believe they're in any sort of consumer technology at all. I believe they sold all that off, and they're just servers and solutions. And wow, that's pretty sweet.
So, yeah. Patrick, what's the Everyone Can Code initiative?
So Apple wants to. Here he goes, and hold on here. I'm putting it into the show. I'm putting it into the show notes right now here. But it says Everyone Can Code. I'm on their Apple website here, and of course they have a very touching film, you know, where people are coding. But it says technology has a language. It's called code, and we believe coding is an essential skill. Learning to code teaches you how to solve problems and work together in creative ways. And it helps you build apps that bring your ideas to life. We think everyone should have the opportunity to create something that can change the world. So we've designed a program that lets anyone learn, write, and teach code. So this is a way that you can learn how to code, but they are targeting more universities and colleges. And they have their own forum and everything.
And this is just a big push for them to get them to use their coding language, which is called Swift. Because I think learning the code is great, but it's a pretty intimidating process because there's so many different languages. So you're like, well, which language do I have to learn, or should I learn? So they're really pushing it. They're really, really pushing it. And they're trying to do like, you know, hour of the code and hour of code and that kind of stuff. They have all sorts of programs there. So yeah, but there you go. And so this way, like, you can actually say, I'm a teacher of Swift, and you can connect through Apple to people who might want to learn code, and they can come to you to, you know, so they're okay. Building a community. And
That's good.
Yeah. Is that all right? I kind of massacred it a little bit, but
yeah, that's fine. And then I looked at one of your talking points, problems with Swift coding. I think that's just going to be based around Apple constantly updating crap, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And also, I didn't know it was so that it can go beyond iOS devices, like there are some server applications. I had no idea about that. And so I thought it's kind of pigeonholing people. They're like, well, you can code for an iPhone, but can you code for, say, like a server? Or could you like write a program that a company needed to handle, you know, a new storefront, online storefront, you know?
I think some of it is pigeonholing. I was looking at their playground sandbox stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And because I have a lot of EV3 devices like Lego, and I'm like, oh, that would be fun. I can't find a way not to have an iPad. It looks like everyone has to have an iPad to interface with like Bluetooth devices.
Yeah.
So that is locking people in. But I think what's interesting about it isn't learning how to do the Apple stuff. It's the language structure. So I think other languages are going to follow suit. That's why I thought about like it needs to be introduced in high school somewhere, so that the kids start to be familiar with a different way to kind of write programs. So they have one concept they seem to have with the Apple stuff. If you're working with Apple stuff, and if you can write apps for the computer, the Apple computer, I don't think it's that limiting. But one concept they have is you can write a single program in a single line. So unlike Java and stuff where you've got to list a bunch of stuff at the top that you need to use, you don't have to do that. You can actually really simplify what you're doing. And I think that's always been a frustrating part, is you waste a lot of time with students teaching them how to prep their files. Just, you've got to set all your files up so that they work. You've got to check your software, not what you're programming, but like the compiler, all this stuff that has to work to make your program happen. And students can get really bogged down in that stuff from day one. And I think sometimes managing the stuff on your laptop is just as hard as programming. And that's why with young students, I start them coding with Scratch and JavaScript because it just works and they don't get frustrated. So it seems like Swift might be a good way to teach some really high level programming that you can use to make actual apps people can run on their computers, but it can skip a lot of the hassle that students have to go through when they're using Java and even Python.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And this now, go ahead.
I was going to say, if any like hardcore Python people hear me say that, they're going to be like, you don't know what you're talking about. It's the greatest thing. It takes nothing. A child could set it up. It's built into your computer already.
That's right. It's just a command. All you need is a command. Get to the command line and you can start writing.
I spent like 3 hours last year with two students trying to figure out what was wrong with their Python on their computers. And I can tell you that if you've got a class of like 20 or 30 students, we're not talking about like a bunch of corporate people going for training, like 4 or 5 of them going for training for 3 days. If you've got like 20 or 30 students and two of them can't get the core software to run, it destroys your entire class.
Yeah.
Like, at least for me, you can't move forward. Like, you can't just be like, well, you two guys, you're done. Sorry. You're not getting it. You're not going to get the project done. So good luck. Go buy a new computer.
Yeah. And one thing to note is for you people out there who have Chromebooks, coding on a Chromebook is difficult. You need to use an online,
yep.
An online coding environment. There's nothing you can, without destroying the Chromebook itself, like literally wiping Chrome OS off it and loading on a version of Linux. You're not going to be able to code on that thing. So just keep that in mind, people. But no, I was looking at this swift.sandbox.bluemix.net, this IBM sandbox, which is
pretty awesome, right?
It's pretty sweet. They got all sorts of they have sample programs that you can load in there too and take a look at them, and that's pretty awesome.
This is a great learning tool just for programming structure. Nothing to install. It's teaching them the Swift structure, which again I think is going to be really common for other languages. They're going to adopt it. They're going to adapt, and they can save it. They can load it from their computer. You can do all the basics, or even way past the basics in this.
Yeah, it's.
I'm going to sign up.
Go for it, man. Let us know how it is. I would be very interested to see. I just didn't know it was so widespread. I thought it was, you know, this. You're writing for an iPad or an iPhone. That's pretty much it. I mean, because the apps on the iWatch are pretty useless, and I used to be an Apple fanboy, but I'm a bit more jaded now, and
that's going to be a completely different. Like, seriously, I just had a meeting about equipment next year, and I'm like, you know, we got to look at Lenovo. I'm just like, we have to consider it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, that's a whole other, yeah, that I agree with you though. It's definitely a downside, because you don't want to like stress a brand. I think 99% of the adoption for Swift is still for Apple devices for sure.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But if it's going to survive and grow, I'm just looking at it as a teaching tool. Like, hey, you guys work with me and learn this using this free IBM stuff. And then if you want to become iOS developers, you'll know how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's pretty sweet. I like it. I think that's there's definitely a lot of iOS devices in the world. I mean, there's a ton of them out there. So,
yep.
If this is something that could, you know, there's, I think everybody kind of agrees, they don't know when it'll happen or how it'll happen, but iOS and macOS will eventually merge into something. And when that happens, it's probably going to be the Swift programming language that everything runs on.
Yeah, is that the singularity where it takes over our brains?
yes it is.
That's what I was worried about.
Absolutely, it is a singularity. Elon Musk has been warning us for years about it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, but it looks really cool. I mean, I like it. I'm into it thus far. I just need to find, maybe I'll do like, see if there's some kids that like really hate all their after school activities and just want to show up and do this. Maybe I'll start with that.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
So, yep. Nice. Well, good one, Patrick. I was actually in the dark here. Like, I knew about Swift, but I lost track of its growth.
I'm glad you did a little bit more research than I did, because I saw that article, and you know, TechCrunch, that's what they do. They want people to use technology and keep people up to date and stuff. So it wasn't a whole lot in that article in itself. It just said it was expanding and that Apple's pushing it. But I didn't know it had Linux capabilities. I think that's pretty sweet. I think it's pretty sweet. So. That is a good find. That was a good find. Do we have anything else we want to talk about? I don't know. Is there anything?
No. I think we're pretty long on time here, so we should cap it off.
We are. We're hitting about to hit the 45-minute mark.
And then I'll try to get my anger under control before we talk about. I'd like to do a podcast on just two subjects: one, the future of people buying only Apple for school, and two, mobile device management solutions and why we're spending thousands of dollars a year to manage free apps.
Absolutely. We are actually reevaluating our MDM solution right now, and we are actually evaluating our one-to-one program, which is iPads. We are really seriously considering Chromebooks, starting to phase out the iPads. I mean, not completely. We'd still have cards. They'd still be resources. But they wouldn't be the one-to-one device that our students would necessarily use. So,
right.
Yeah. So anyhow, I think that's a fantastic topic. And Omar even touched on that a couple weeks ago on episode 142. So maybe we can try to wrangle Omar. Hopefully he doesn't play the dad card. It's the only thing
he's going to.
He's going to try. He's going to try. So we got to schedule it well in advance. So anyway, for IT Babble, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Tony.
And keep on babbling out there, and we'll catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.